What do we mean when we talk about modern slavery? How is the slavery of the 16, 17, and 1800s different than the slavery that's happening now? Why aren't the international laws against slavery working? Are you and I implicated in modern slavery? Find out answers to these questions on this episode of The End of the Law. Hello and welcome to The End of the Law, the show that looks at what happens when the extremes of humanity meet the fringes of the law. Every other week, I pick out some news story or current event and explore it with existing law to find out how the law deals with modern messes. I'm Grant Shubin, and I'm the captain. Today's episode is about modern slavery, about the forms it takes, slavery's legacy in international law, examples where slavery is happening today, and about how international criminal law is not being enforced to bring slavery to an end. To help me tackle all this, I have with me in the studio today two legal experts to help paint the picture on this unthinkable issue. Julie Opperman is a legal historian who specializes in the study of the American institution of slavery, though she's recently shifted her focus to combating all forms of modern slavery. She's worked with the Legacies of British Slave Ownership Project at the University College in London and currently works as an advisor at the UN. Sina Alavi is a human rights lawyer in New York City. He specializes in international criminal law. He's studied international law and policy all over the world, and probably most importantly, is a graduate of UC Hastings College of the Law. Same as me. Before we get into that, though, I got a few things to take care of. First, Radio Free Brooklyn is now on Patreon, a community website where you can help support us by becoming a patron. All of us here at Radio Free Brooklyn are volunteers, so any donations go directly to helping the station, and I'm literally talking about things like keeping the lights on. If you like this show or any of the other 55 original shows here on Radio Free Brooklyn, go to www.patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn and become a patron. Also, send me emails. Today is the sixth show, and up to this point, we've covered surveillance, refugees, gun control, gender and genocide, drone killings, and modern slavery. In the future, I hope to cover shows about stripping citizenship, LGBTQ rights in international law, Guantanamo, Sharia law. If you're not hearing something that you want to know about, let me know. The show's email is theendofthelaw@gmail.com. And finally, a brief recap and question from our last show. You might remember the last time we talked about the legality of drone killings by the U.S. government. And actually, we talked about the illegality of the U.S. drone program. We looked at the program under the law of armed conflict or international humanitarian law and found that the program wouldn't be permissible because those laws only apply to conflict. And the U.S. is conducting those strikes in countries we are not at war with and against people who aren't necessarily part of a cohesive enemy. We then looked at the program under the law of self-defense and figured out that in order for the U.S. to use armed force in self-defense, it must be in response to the immediate threat of attack where there's basically no other choice, which isn't always the case for drone killings. We also looked at the law governing law enforcement, but we found that that was too highly variable and varies from state to state, and that's not a good legal anchor for the program. Ultimately, though, the program gets by, not because it's legal, but because each of these areas of law gives it just enough legal justification for the program that when you put them together, it sounds like a legitimate legal argument, even though it's an untenable Frankenstein cobbling together of the laws. Given that the program is a legal stretch, Bill from Los Angeles asked, who polices the program? Who holds the U.S. accountable? Well, Bill, the short answer is no one. International law is a permissive system, meaning that something is allowed unless it's explicitly not allowed. So you don't have a lot of policing going on. That's part of what's so scary about the program. By having this policy of drone killings anyone, anywhere, the U.S. is setting the rules for when other countries get armed drones. The longer answer is basically no one holds the U.S. accountable. The program caused a bit of a stir, and you'll get statements from the UN Secretary General or the High Commissioner of Human Rights or the Special Representative for Human Rights and Fighting Terrorism, but condemnations from those people are hardly holding the U.S. accountable. But enough of that. Let's move to today's show, modern slavery. Today, there's an estimated 35.8 million slaves in the world. That's a lot. That's the population of Canada. These slaves account for $150 billion a year in economic activity. That's a lot. That's the same as the yearly economic activity of Kansas. And these jobs are as dangerous and unhealthy as you might expect. If all the world's slaves lived in one country, that country would have the world's third largest carbon footprint, behind only China and the U.S. But, Julie, and I meant to say hi earlier, but I didn't. Hi, Julie. Julie, what even is modern slavery? Is it any different than the slavery we learned about in school?
Well, first I'd like to say thanks for having me on the show. And before I answer your question, I'd like to just say a few words about what I've learned from talking to people about modern-day slavery, and which I believe is actually quite telling of one of the main problems that we're facing with regard to modern-day slavery. So the first thing that always strikes me is people's reaction. When I tell someone, for example, that over 35.8 million men, women, and children are trapped in slavery at this very moment all over the world, people aren't just surprised, but they're shocked. And this feels especially true when I speak to Americans for whom slavery is an important part of their collective consciousness and who, because of their history, were made to study the American Civil War and the abolition of slavery at some point during their education. However, this type of legalized chattel slavery, which is what most people have in mind when they think of slavery, has become virtually extinct. And just to be clear, in chattel slavery, slaves are actual property that can be bought and sold and even inherited. So while the practice of chattel slavery has become mostly extinct, modern forms of slavery don't only persist, but they're widespread and they're thriving. So answering your question, what actually is modern-day slavery? It's actually one I get quite a lot. And I think the important thing to remember is that modern-day slavery is multifaceted. So nowadays, slavery no longer comes in the obvious form of chattel slavery, in which one person owns another person, but it comes in many different forms. And it's because modern-day slavery exists in all these different forms over time and place that I think providing a precise and single definition of what exactly constitutes a modern slave is kind of complicated. However, I do believe that a certain pattern transcends. So modern slaves are not free to leave, they're prone to economic exploitation, they're often under the constant threat of violence, and most importantly, they're hidden from society. So in that way, modern slavery can mean debt bondage, it can mean sexual slavery, forced marriage, forced labor, and so on. And it can be found in fishing fleets in Bangladesh, private homes in Belgium, construction sites in Qatar, supply chains in Brazil, and even here in the US. So these examples are just to show you that slavery is versatile, it is widespread, and it can be found in both developed and developing countries.
Grant, if I can just jump in and add to what Julie was saying. In the context of a legal discussion, modern slavery is really just an umbrella term. So speaking strictly legally, the term modern slavery encompasses several specific crimes like enslavement, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, and the trafficking of persons, just to name a few.
Thanks. And hi, Sina. I meant to say hi to you as well. Got ahead of myself. So thank you. I think that's a very important distinction to make. And just to touch on a little bit of what Julie was saying, chattel slavery, which is the slavery that we talk about historically, that invokes a legal word, chattel, which, as Sina and Julie know, chattel is like a form of property. So you can commit trespass to chattel, and that would be if I were to steal Sina's microphone from him. So that's a very important legal word. But when we were preparing for the show, we also talked about the history of modern slavery. And you guys talked about how the role that international law played in the abolition of chattel slavery. And I'm hoping you can fill that in a bit. That is, how was the abolition of the slave trade connected to the history of the human rights movement as we think of it?
Well, what most people are actually unaware of is that the history of international human rights law dates back to the movement for the abolition of the slave trade in the 19th century. So usually when you talk to people about the notion of international human rights or international criminal courts, the first things that come to mind are the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or the Nuremberg trials after World War II. So I think we tend to think of international human rights law as a mid-20th century phenomenon, but that's actually not true. And if you look, for example, at the development of international human rights law more broadly, some historians have even called the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade the most successful episode ever in the history of international human rights law. Even the phrase crime against humanity, which became kind of well known by its use at the Nuremberg trials, actually has its origin in the 19th century, the slave trade being the original crime against humanity. So just to come back to the history again, Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, and after doing so, the British government wanted other countries to abolish the slave trade as well. This decision was motivated by a combination of economic, social, and political factors, but I think the most pertinent one was that the British had come to believe that slavery was morally wrong. And I think it was this fundamental shift in consciousness which gave rise to the idea of international human rights law. So the slave trade was not just a crime that disregarded and undermined the humanity of its victims, but it was an offense that aroused the concern of humanity more generally, and therefore affected not just the victims themselves, but the entire international community. And Jenny Martinez, who is a very prominent human rights lawyer at Stanford, she also argues that the widespread adoption of treaties against the slave trade introduced the idea that violation of human rights were offenses of concern to humankind generally, and not just matters between a people and their sovereign. So once the British government had abolished the slave trade, Britain started persuading one country after another to sign these bilateral treaties suppressing the slave trade. And then they created international courts to enforce them. These courts were called mixed commission courts because representatives from different countries presided over them. They were set up in countries all over the Atlantic. Just to give you a few examples, like Sierra Leone, Cuba, Brazil, Suriname. And even though the courts only existed for a short period of time, around 50 years, historians have estimated that the courts were responsible for freeing nearly 80,000 slaves. So these slave trade tribunals were actually the first international human rights courts which aimed to promote humanitarian objectives.
Wow, that's really interesting. It's interesting to hear that the framing of the issue of slavery being a violation against humankind generally dates back to that time, because I know that that's something Sina is going to get into, but as human rights lawyers, we grapple with all the time. But one question I have is, why was international law so successful at abolishing slavery historically, but it struggles with modern-day slavery?
Well, I think the short answer to that is that the world superpower at the time, which was Britain, put its entire weight behind ending the slave trade in terms of both soft and hard power. So Britain was the greatest naval power at the time, so the logical solution, of course, to enforce the abolition of the slave trade was military power. But even with the entire British fleet patrolling the Atlantic Ocean, some slave ships were obviously bound to slip through their fingers. So what they needed was not just unilateral military power, but a comprehensive legal framework, which other countries would sign on to as well. So over the next several decades, Britain started convincing other countries to ratify these international treaties banning the slave trade. And I think this process of persuasion, if we want to call it like that, was obviously made a lot easier by the fact that Britain could use its economic and military power to kind of bring reluctant treaty partners back into the legal fold. So in short, it was the combination of military power, international law, and coordinated legal action that was necessary to bring the slave trade to an end. However, and I really want to highlight this, is that we shouldn't underestimate the importance of a mass global social movement. And if it hadn't been for the long and persistent effort of the abolitionist movement, who knows how Britain's international campaign to end the slave trade would have actually played out. So before you could even think about changing the law, you really needed to rally up support. And in the specific context of the 19th century, you needed to answer one very pertinent question. Were slaves property that could be legally bought and sold, or were they people with civil rights?
If I can just jump in again, Grant, I think your question about why international human rights law or international law has had trouble tackling the slavery issue today really zeroes in on the issue I want to talk about, namely the gap between the very strong international laws and norms on slavery that exist and their enforcement, which I call the enforcement gap. So at the international level, there are norms against slavery that are incredibly strong. They're up there with genocide as what we call Jus Cogens norms that create erga omnes obligations.
And if I could just jump in for all the non-Latin, non-law students out there, and Jus Cogens and erga omnes are terms that human rights lawyers use to talk about the strongest international legal norms. Jus Cogens are fundamental overriding principles of international law. They're peremptory. They allow no derogation, ever. And where Jus Cogens refers to laws, erga omnes refers to obligations. They're obligations owed by all states to all states. Anyway, sorry, Sina, back to you.
Right, thanks for that. Slavery is also explicitly condemned and outlawed by binding international treaties, regional human rights instruments, and internationally recognized declarations, like what Julie just mentioned, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as well as the 1926 Slavery Convention and the Supplementary Convention on the Abolition of Slavery. But despite all these norms, treaties, the fact that the history of human rights law itself is intertwined with the abolition of the slave trade, there's still a huge gap here between law and practice. So the question then really becomes, how can we use the international instruments and mechanisms that already exist to help us close this gap? Today I wanted to specifically discuss the role the International Criminal Court could play in fighting modern-day slavery.
So, Sina, you mentioned the International Criminal Court's role, but I'm thinking maybe we should set a foundation for what that is so the listeners have an idea about what we're referring to and how it can be powerful in getting rid of modern slavery.
No, I think that's a great idea. So maybe I should start at the beginning and explain what the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, is. Yeah. The ICC, which has its seat in The Hague, is a permanent international judicial body capable of trying individuals for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. But the ICC, I have to say, is a court of last resort, which means that it's only there to complement national systems. And it steps in when states are unwilling or unable to investigate or prosecute war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. And when we talk about slavery specifically, what makes the ICC different than other international tribunals is that it's the only international court with the jurisdiction to prosecute slavery crimes outside of conflict situations.
What exactly do you mean? In what situations can slavery-related crimes be prosecuted at the ICC?
So the Rome Statute of the ICC criminalizes as crimes against humanity the crime of enslavement, sexual slavery, and enforced prostitution. In narrower cases, the statute criminalizes, again, sexual slavery and enforced prostitution as war crimes. So there's a distinction here that needs to be made between crimes against humanity and war crimes. And the critical difference between them is that, unlike war crimes, crimes against humanity do not need to be committed during an armed conflict situation. And that's exactly why I think the ICC could have a strong role to play in the fight against slavery, because many instances of modern slavery that are occurring today that Julie was just talking about could potentially be prosecuted by the court as crimes against humanity.
So what exactly is the scope of prosecution of slavery-related crimes at the ICC?
That's a great question, because unfortunately there are limitations to the ICC's ability to prosecute. The main one being that the ICC has territorial and nationality-based limitations to its jurisdiction, which in simple terms means that the ICC cannot go after crimes that occurred in a country that is not party to the court statute, nor can it go after citizens of countries that are not party to its statute.
And what you mean by when states aren't parties to the statute, that means they haven't signed and ratified the treaty.
Right, like the United States hasn't ratified
the Rome statute. Yeah. So if prosecutions are somewhat limited because of the limited nationality and territorial-based jurisdictional limitations to the ICC, tell us about how the UN Security Council can play a role.
Again, a great question. So the UN Security Council does have a role to play vis-a-vis the ICC in that it can expand the ICC's jurisdiction if it refers a situation to the court. So just to give you real-life examples, the Security Council has already referred two cases to the ICC, the case of Sudan and Libya. And they had a vote on referring Syria to the court. However, China and Russia used their veto powers as permanent members on the Security Council to block the Syria referral. I mean, that brings up the point that the Security Council is first and foremost a political body. And as we saw with the Syria referral, its members chose to veto a situation that involved a state that they share close ties with. This is why, in my opinion, vetoes should never be used to block referrals of situations where atrocity crimes are being committed.
And there's actually a movement at the UN for exactly that right now, isn't there?
Right. So there's this new international norm that's trying to gain traction. It's called the responsibility not to veto. So states are calling on the Security Council to refrain from veto when they're voting on something that involves atrocity crimes. So genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, ethnic cleansing.
But what about, I know that part of ICC jurisdiction invokes problems of scale and gravity. So can you fill that in a little bit?
So there are other practical obstacles to ICC prosecution of slavery crimes, like we have to ask questions of whether the crime in question meets the Rome Statute's scale and gravity thresholds, or does corporate action constitute an organizational policy as it's understood under the Rome Statute system? But these are really technical questions, which I don't think we have time to get into right now. But I will say that I think all of the obstacles to ICC prosecution of slavery that I've mentioned and you've mentioned have potential solutions. There's no dead end, you know, just for lack of a better word. So if we can go back to the Syria case, I think it's one where the ICC should have already taken action, because there's evidence that ISIS has captured and enslaved women and girls in Syria and Iraq. Now, neither Syria nor Iraq is party to the Rome Statute, but certain members of ISIS are citizens of countries that are party to the court. ISIS has members with diverse nationalities, coming from countries like the UK, Germany, Belgium, Australia, and Jordan. And all of those countries are members of the court. So based on the Rome Statute's personal jurisdiction provisions, it could go after those members of ISIS. And we also know that ISIS is actively sponsoring and promoting chattel slavery. So if we go back to what Julie just said, that's the kind of one person straight up owns another person kind of slavery that we thought we had more or less gotten rid of. But no, it still exists, and ISIS is practicing it right now. According to an ISIS video, they're selling women aged 40 to 50 for $40, and then women aged 20 to 30 for $80, and a girl under the age of 9 is going for $160. When I first saw this, it was really hard to wrap my head around it because there's a price sheet for female slaves where the price increases as the age of the woman or girl decreases. It's horrendous.
So, Sina, noting that ISIS is committing all these slavery crimes and that there are jurisdictional limits to what the ICC can do, what are they doing or can they do anything?
So far, the ICC has said that it will not yet investigate ISIS crimes because the ISIS members that have the nationalities that would allow the court to establish personal jurisdiction are not senior enough to give the court jurisdiction over the most responsible for the crimes, which is another limitation that the court has. So at the moment, absent a Security Council referral, the court cannot go after ISIS for its appalling slavery crimes or any of its other crimes for that matter. Which brings me to the point again that we should call on the Security Council to in the future refrain from using the veto in situations of mass atrocities.
So if I could touch on for a second the not senior enough requirement. A bunch of Yazidi groups submitted briefings to the ICC asking the prosecutor to open a preliminary examination. And the ICC prosecutor said, no, we can't. There's no one senior enough because the ICC prosecutor has an internal policy with to only try those most responsible at the highest levels. And
that's exactly what I was referring to. So the court is apprehensive to investigate because the members that it would have jurisdiction over, the ISIS members that it would have jurisdiction over because of their nationalities, are not part of ISIS leadership. So the court has this policy of going after those most responsible for the crimes that are being committed. And the people with the right nationalities to open the case are not considered most responsible. But I want to end, Grant, by saying that although there are significant limitations to what the ICC can do in the fight against slavery, that doesn't mean that it can't have an impact. And while the ICC definitely cannot eradicate modern slavery by itself, it can help lead a more coordinated campaign against modern slavery. That should also include the UN, civil society organizations, domestic litigation, and the media to help raise public awareness around the issue. It's also imperative to say that even if the ICC gets more directly involved in the fight against modern slavery, it won't change the root causes of modern slavery, like extreme poverty and the corporate demand for ever cheaper labor. But just like the British did in the 19th century with regard to the slave trade, the ICC can help set the moral standard that the international community needs to live up to with regard to slavery. And it can help by opening a few prominent investigations, perhaps into the case of Yazidi women being enslaved in Iraq and Syria, which would, at the very least, help bring more international attention to the issue. And like what Julie mentioned earlier, why in the 19th century the movement for the abolition of the slave trade was so successful is because the British helped set a moral standard that created a mass social movement as well around the laws and the international courts that existed. And I think this is what the ICC can do today with regard to modern slavery.
Yeah, the ICC is a tool to build like a broader movement, basically.
Right.
Well, funny you should mention that because that's something I want to talk about in my little closing remarks. But before we do that, I do want to play one of my favorite songs ever, Public Enemy, Can't Trust It, about the American institution of slavery.
They started on slave ships.
Slave ships. There are more records of slave ships than one would dream. It seems inconceivable until you reflect that for 200 years ships sailed carrying cargoes of slaves.
Non-violent. In the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years, is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Put the booty down.
Go get to the roots. And giving it up. So turn me loose.
All right, so what does all this mean? Well, Julie and Sina helped me point out that despite the strongest international laws and history's ability to dispose of it, slavery still persists. It's weaved in the carpets we buy. It's in the chocolate and the sugar we eat. It's in the coal we burn and the clothing we wear. It's in our jewelry and in the metal in our cell phones. It's even in the tobacco and marijuana we smoke. It's in the coffee we drink and the pornography we watch. It's even in bricks. It's literally in bricks, the physical things we use to build society. It's a problem. And it's a problem that's not being addressed. Yes, there are laws, very important laws, that ban modern slavery in all its forms. But like Sina talked about, these laws are not being enforced. And that should not be taken as an indictment of the failures of international criminal law, because international criminal law can only do so much. The fact of the matter is, the economic incentive is there. Slaves are cheap, not very dangerous, and the products they make are in high demand. Lucrative economics will outmaneuver the law no matter how strong the law is. Still, any condition in the world only exists because we allow it. We tolerated piracy until we started fighting and holding pirates accountable. We allowed for gross corporate exploitation until we formed and allowed unions. And, most obviously, we accepted slavery until we abolished it. Sure, we fought a war in the process, but that's how awful slavery was to us. We fought one of the bloodiest wars in our history to get rid of it. And slavery has since shifted into a different and less obvious space in our society. Slaves are overseas. They're in factories or basements or cargo containers and even in homes. They're behind a long and complicated supply chain. But just because slavery is hidden and has strong international laws banning it does not make it any less morally imperative for us to end it. Slavery is just as bad now as it was in the 1800s, and I would argue that it's our social duty to end it now just like we did then, both through the enforcement of international law through prosecutions, but also through some grassroots effort from all of us. In other words, and this is a bit of a bummer, but since we're all likely implicated in modern slavery, it's on all of us to figure out a way to end it. It's not that we're all bad people. We're not. It's almost that slavery has become more sinister than it was in yesteryear. It's hiding in plain sight. And I don't mean to be preachy about it, and I'm just as bad as the rest of us. I certainly don't make any extra efforts to ensure that I'm not buying a product made by slaves. And to be honest, I'm not even entirely sure what fair trade means anymore. I guess the point isn't that it's hopeless. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Yes, slavery exists, and it's a problem. But we beat it with our old tools in its old form, and we can beat it with new tools in its new form. Whereas the British basically had to use military power, we can use the internet and social media and an unprecedented ability to communicate with one another, to unite and identify issues that we want to do something about. But it's going to take us, it's going to take all of us to put this monster to bed once and for all. One place that you might start if you're interested is freetheslaves.net. That's it for today's show. Like I mentioned a bit earlier, Radio Free Brooklyn is now on Patreon, which is a way for listeners just like you to support the people keeping this station going. Go to www.patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn to sign up to be a patron for as little as $1 a month to keep the lights on here. Also, send me emails. Tell me what you want to hear. Tell me what you don't want to hear. Tell me anything you like. And the show's email is theendofthelaw@gmail.com. I'm Grant Shubin. Big thanks to Julie Opperman and Sina Alavi for getting in the mix today. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is The End of the Law, and this is the end of the show. Thanks for listening.